Anybody who's lived here for more than 10 minutes going around sabotaging anything. That could kill somebody, for Christ's sakes. Maybe so, the mercenary said. But Stavanger's worried about it, and he asked me to check out his suit. She puffed out a breath between her teeth. Okay, okay. It sounds wonky to me, but if the boss wants you to check his suit, go right ahead. She folded her arms across her chest and stood there, solidly planted, not budging. The mercenary went through the motions of checking Doug's hard suit, wishing she would go away, knowing she wouldn't, and telling himself that he'd have to come back when Leibowitz was off duty and some less dedicated technician was on the job. "When's your shift end?" he asked as he looked over the seal ring on Doug's helmet.
"Same's yours."
"I'm working directly for Stavanger. No shifts. It's 24 hours a day for me." She humphed.
"Well, I'm on a day shift, as you can see. I finish at 4, just like everybody else."
The mercenary returned the helmet to its rack above the suit. "How about having dinner with me?" 7 o'clock in the cave? She gave him a quizzical look. The mercenary knew exactly what was going through her mind. Would she want to be seen having dinner with a black man?
"Okay," she said guardedly. 7 o'clock at the cave."
It took him a couple of heartbeats to realize she had accepted. "See you there," he said, with a genuine smile. And as he walked away down the long line of empty spacesuits hanging like medieval arrays of armor with their helmets racked above them, he thought that after dinner with her, he'd return and finish the job here. Stavanger's going to go outside sooner or later, and when he does, a malfunction in his suit is going to kill him. Later that day, Doug was in Ginny Anson's office, meeting with the base director and the heads of the mining, transportation, and research divisions. Anson had rearranged the furniture so that the oblong conference table now butted against the desk like the vertical leg of a letter T. Chris Cardenas was also sitting at the table, across from Zoltan Kadar, the astronomer. No one had invited the Hungarian to this strategy meeting. He had shown up with the others and grabbed a chair before anyone could shoo him away. His precious survey satellite to Farside had been launched the day before, so Doug wondered what he wanted now. And sitting silently on the couch along the far wall of the office was Bam Gordette, silently watching, listening. "He's become like my shadow," Doug thought. "Everywhere I go, he goes. He doesn't say anything, but he takes in everything with those dark brown eyes, like a detective looking over a crime scene." Then a new thought struck Doug. "Maybe Bam thinks he's my bodyguard. He sure acts like one." The thought made him smile to himself. "I don't need a bodyguard here, not in Moonbase." But it made him feel almost grateful to Gordette for caring enough to act as one. Doug took the chair at the foot of the table, facing Anson, who sat behind her desk. "I've asked you here, most of you anyway," he added, with a wry grin in Kadar's direction, "to talk over the chances of developing defenses against the next peacekeeper assault."
"You think they'll be back, then?" said Deborah Payne.
Head of the research division, she had a frizzy blonde hairdo and an hourglass figure that had driven many men to distraction. She happened to be a very serious biologist, a top-flight science administrator, and a cheerful lesbian.
"They'll be back," Doug said. "Faure's delaying any negotiations as much as he can. He's going to try to take us by force before agreeing to any compromise."
"We don't want any compromise either," Anson snapped. "It's independence or bust."
Harry Clemens, the transportation division chief, clasped both hands behind his bald head and tilted his chair so far back Doug was afraid it would fall over.
"So we've got to be prepared to defend ourselves, then?"
"That's right," said Doug.
"Against what?"
"More peacekeeper troops," said Vince Falcone, head of the mining division.
"Worse than that," Clemens said in his mild, soft way.
"Like what?"
Falcone asked.
"One modest nuclear warhead exploded a few hundred meters above the crater floor could knock out all our solar farms,"
Doug countered. "But we still got the nuclear backup. It's buried."
"Nuclear warhead number 2 will be a ground blast to knock out our generator."
Falcone nodded solemnly.
"The second one doesn't even have to be a nuclear warhead. Conventional warhead will do if they've got the generator pinpointed.
Okay, said Doug, looking at each of them in turn. The first thing we've got to do is figure out what they can throw at us. Then we've got to look for ways to defend ourselves against each possible threat.
Lots of luck, Falcone grumbled.
He was built like a fireplug, with short, thick arms and a nearly perpetual scowl on his dark face. Instead of the usual coveralls, he preferred to wear dark turtlenecks and comfortable, loose-fitting jeans that he jammed into scuffed old cowboy boots.
There may be a way to defend against a nuclear warhead, said Deborah Payne.
Doug felt his eyebrows hike halfway to his scalp.
The physicists have been using the mass driver's magnets to power a particle accelerator, Payne said. If we could focus the beam on an incoming warhead, it could destroy the nuclear device's switching and fusing mechanisms.
Are you sure? Doug asked.
It's actually pretty old stuff, she replied, from the anti-missile defenses that the peacekeepers maintain in Earth orbit.
So it turns the nuke into a dud, huh?
Falcone asked.
Yes. The warhead will crash onto the crater floor, but the bomb won't go off.
That'd still do some damage to the solar panels, Clemens pointed out.
Yeah, but not that many of them, said Falcone.
Doug asked, could we actually focus the particle beam that way?
Payne shrugged.
It looked delicious to all the men around the table, even though they knew she didn't do it for their benefit.
I'll have to ask the physicists about it, she said. We should have plenty of time to aim the beam if they fire the missile from Earthside. Days.
Suppose they take over L1 and use it as a staging base. They could fire the missile from there.
Nodding, Payne said, that would still give us a couple of hours or so, maybe more.
Maybe less, Anson said, if they fire it at high boost.
Maybe.
Doug turned to Cardenas. Chris, what are you and Zimmerman developing? Anything useful? She sighed.
Willie's got this bug in his ear about using nanomachines to make a person invisible. I was hoping something practical might come out of it, but so far as I can tell, he hasn't accomplished a thing.
And your own work? Doug prompted.
We can be a big help medically, of course. As far as weaponry is concerned, I haven't come up with anything except the gobblers. We can program them to eat metals, if you like.
We can't strew the whole crater floor with gobblers, Doug said.
Why not? Anson shot back. It'll only be for a short time.
Doug ticked off on his fingers. One, they'll most likely land during daylight.
You can program gobblers to operate in sunlight, can't you? Anson asked Cardenas.
It's more difficult, but doable. I'd worry about deactivating them, though.
Two, Doug went on. What's to stop the gobblers from destroying our solar farms, the launch pads and their equipment, even the mass driver?
Anson pursed her lips. Then she grinned.
Yeah, it would be like shooting ourselves in the foot, wouldn't it?
Shooting ourselves in the head, Clemens said with surprising fervor.
Doug realized he wanted no part of nanomachines that ate metals. Turning in his chair to look at Gordette, Doug asked,
Bam, if you were in charge of the peacekeepers, how would you go about taking Moonbase?
Gordette shook his head. I wasn't an officer, just a dog face.
You're as close to a general as we've got here, Anson said.
What do you think they're going to do? Doug repeated.
Slowly, reluctantly, Gordette got to his feet. All eyes focused on him.
Well, to begin with, I agree with Mr. Clemens. They'll start with a bombardment to knock out our electrical power.
Nuclear warheads?
Most likely. But they might use a conventional warhead for our nuclear generator if they know its location precisely enough.
They've got the same maps we use, Falcone grumbled.
Then what? Doug asked.
Most likely they'd have already landed troops outside the crater on the Mare Nubium side. They'll wait for the bombardment, then come over Vodyahovich Pass to get into the base.
Doug saw most of the people around the table nodding agreement.
If our electrical power is out, all they'll have to do is knock on our door. We'll have to surrender to them.
We have the fuel cells, Anson said.
Gordette shrugged. How long do they give us? A few days? A few hours?
The peacekeepers will be occupying the crater floor. We'll have no chance to repair the solar farms. We'll be forced to give up.
A nuclear blast probably'd screw up our radiators, too, Falcone pointed out. We'd be boiling in here inside of a few hours.